From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This afternoon, the Senate formally received articles of impeachment against President Trump ahead of the trial beginning Tuesday. And landing in the middle of all this, Lev Parnas, the indicted associate of Trump personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani, who's been making astonishing claims in a series of interviews that all aid to Ukraine, not just military aid, was conditional on Ukraine announcing an investigation of Joe Biden, that it's laughable to think corruption had anything to do with it, that the president himself and all the top players on Trump's team were in on it, including Attorney General William Barr. Here's Lev Parnas on MSNBC last night with Rachel Maddow.
Do you know if Mr. Giuliani was ever in contact with Mr. Barr specifically about the fact that he was trying to get Ukraine to announce these investigations into Joe Biden?
Oh, absolutely.
Mr. Barr knew about that.
Mr. Barr had to have known everything.
Well, the Justice Department denies that. There's also word today from the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office that President Trump broke the law by holding up aid to Ukraine. And Parnas had documents from an obscure Republican candidate for Congress, Robert Hyde, that showed Hyde was surveilling former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Texas Democrat Sylvia Garcia is one of the seven House impeachment managers named yesterday. Congresswoman, welcome on this hectic day.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And first of all, I'm imagining you might have to couch some of your comments about Lev Parnas. This is all just being digested. But your reaction when suddenly these interviews started spilling out, we know that information that his lawyer sent documents and information to the House, but now his comments, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of things that I cannot talk about related to this. But I think what's important is that it underscores our point that we do need to have the ability to have witnesses testify in this trial. And we do need to make sure that all the documents that are relevant to this case are made available to the committee so that we can present as evidence to the Senate. All along, you know, the president has stonewalled. He's ordered agencies not to cooperate. He's ordered witnesses not to testify. And if we don't have any witnesses at this trial, it will be the first time in the history of our country that we don't have witnesses testify at an impeachment trial. So it underscores our point. We are, like you, digesting the information. Our staff is going through it. And as soon as we can, all the managers will have a discussion and decide where to go from there.
You know that Vice President Mike Pence's office is saying Parnas is under indictment. He'll say anything. White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham accused Parnas of going on an anti-Trump media tour, says Trump denies knowing him. We should say that there are pictures of them together. And Parnas has been saying in these interviews, what, we didn't watch football games together? I mean, he feels he can prove that he very much did know Trump. So, again, does this mean if you as House managers decide this Parnas evidence, whether it's his interviews or the paperwork, the texts, all the incriminating letters and things he has, if you want that in the trial, does that just go directly into the trial, or does someone else have to decide if it's admissible?
No, it's I don't want to get ahead of the managers or Adam Schiff, our lead manager, and we're not there yet. But because we want it presented, doesn't mean that
right.
It's going to get in. It would have to be a vote of the senators.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that it would be a simple majority vote of the senators.
Well, and so everything has to be voted on and decided in some way that we're all going to find out how it gets entered into this trial. Who would you like to see be a witness?
Well, again, that's a discussion that the managers have not, debated and decided. And
but
of course,
members of the
Senate, some senators also have ideas. And I come in, as a manager with an open mind. And again, I'm not going to get ahead of any of my colleagues. For me, as a member of judiciary, we have tried to get Don McGahn before us during the whole investigation. Of course, he was ordered not to appear, as all witnesses were ordered not to appear.
He was the White House counsel. The Mueller report indicated that he said he was asked to fabricate a story by President Trump. And you've noted that you were a judge. You were also a lawyer. One of the first two Latina congressmen from Texas. I mean, this is a historic moment. Just to your sense of what you might help bring to it.
For me, it's mixed emotions. I'm honored, and I sense the deep responsibility we have in protecting the Constitution and protecting our democracy and seeking the truth. But above that, it's also about ensuring to all Americans that no one is above the law and that we cannot allow a president to interfere with our elections and to seek a foreign government in undermining or interfering or in any way tempering with our elections. It's something that's ingrained in us. So for me to see a president pick up a phone and do what this president has done is just outrageous, and he should be held accountable.
Well, again, I know you can't get over your skis, but so you were appalled by that. And now we're hearing, you know, how many others in his White House might have known, and that there was no question, at least to someone who was involved, it was never about corruption. I mean, this has got to add to your feelings about it.
Well, it underscores why we've got to have all relevant witnesses, all relevant documents, and a fair trial to the American people. Because if we don't, then it is a fake trial. It's a rigged trial. It's a cover-up.
That's the Texas Democrat Sylvia Garcia, one of seven House impeachment managers presenting the case against President Trump in the trial that starts next Tuesday. Congresswoman Garcia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The U.S. Senate voted today to pass a revised trade deal between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And yesterday, there was another trade development when President Trump signed the first phase of a trade pact with China. Trump hailed it as a big, beautiful agreement.
This is a very large deal, the China deal. It covers tremendous manufacturing, farming, a lot of rules, regulations, a lot of things are covered.
China, however, has struck a more cautious tone. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, joins us to talk about it more. Robin, let's start with the phase one trade deal with China. The president is very happy about it. What does it include?
I mean, huge numbers all around. I mean, massive agreed upon purchases across. You talk about agriculture, energy, manufacturing and services. This year, Tanya, China has to buy at least $77 billion extra of U.S. goods and services. Next year, at least $123 billion extra. You tally that up, that's $200 billion over 2 years, the majority of which would come from our manufacturers. And that's just an unprecedented ramp up we're expecting from China.
Yeah. Are American companies and consumers the winners or losers in this? I'm reading this new deal cuts in half tariff rates on billions of dollars worth of goods, but most of the higher duties will remain in place. Your thoughts?
Yeah. China being a $14 trillion economy, this could be a huge boon for all manner of U.S. companies, farms and the people they employ across the board. And this is at a time when the U.S. is already at full employment. Even so, punitive tariffs remain on about $360 billion worth of Chinese products. And the Chinese are penalizing our farm belt in kind, though some at lower rates than before. So you already have critics. They're both political and private sector critics wondering if we blinked without kind of extracting more tangible relief and access out of Beijing.
What about, you mentioned farmers, what about farmers and manufacturers specifically?
Yeah, to meet the bar for 2021, China is going to have to import upwards of $40 billion in U.S. farm goods, which I saw the Wall Street Journal calculates is a 90% jump from 2017 levels. The biggest cut of the headline, $200 billion, you're going to see much of that come from American manufacturers. And manufacturing trade is targeted to jump $45 billion next year from beginning levels.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, he criticized the president's deal and said it was too weak, wondering what China is saying about it.
China isn't doing much in the way of running victory laps. I think the devil's really going to be in the details, and the skeptics are already hitting this idea that the U.S., who's the global torchbearer for free markets and market economies, is leaning on Beijing, which is the king of central planning, to kickstart this unprecedented two-year surge in purchases from the U.S. So there is this dissonance, if you will.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the other big thing that happened today. The Senate voted on Trump's revised North American trade deal with Canada and Mexico, which replaces NAFTA. What kind of effect will these two trade deals together have on the economy.
It's now called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA for short, and it won overwhelming support in a most divided Senate. You saw an 89-10 vote. It's a major rewrite of NAFTA that also spans agriculture, manufacturing, and services, and it won both Republican and Democratic support by demanding, yes, more export opportunities from the Rust Belt and some labor and environmental protections. Again, a lot of it is in the implementation and deliverables. And a lot of this is going to happen after November. So let's see who is elected.
Yeah. And the timeline, too, for phase two of the China trade agreement, what's the timeline for that?
You're going to see the United States try to get into aggressive negotiations to try to get China to stop subsidizing its state-owned enterprises. Some harder trophies to win back. But I think you're going to see in an election year that they'll probably be delivered.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It won't come as news to anyone that the online world can be isolating, is contributing to rage, depression, extremism. There have also been studies that show that empathy, the ability to share and understand another person's feelings, has declined sharply in the 21st century. Well, our next guest writes, if it dies out completely, technology will be charged with the murder. But he's also found ways the web can foster empathy and spirituality. We've been taking a look at secular spirituality, a deep relationship with the human spirit outside of religious tenets. Today, spirituality in technology. Jamil Zaki teaches psychology at Stanford University, where his research includes empathy and social interaction. He also teaches a class on being kinder. We'll visit that in another program. His article, The Technology of Kindness, appeared in Scientific American. His recent book is The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. And he joins us from Stanford. Jamil, professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that this isn't coincidental, this fall in things like compassion, because major platforms like Facebook and Twitter are designed to amplify our worst angels. 70% of YouTube views come from the site's recommendations. So you see the things they think will get retweets, like conspiracy theories and bigotry. Is that pretty much the point?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you rewind to 10 years ago and look at an old issue of Wired, people were breathless thinking about the wonderful global community that we'd be able to have through the internet. And I think that that potential remains. But I don't think it's been fulfilled. And part of that is because technology platforms don't sort of help their shareholders by making users feel happy or socially connected, but by keeping them online. And so those platforms have been built, therefore, to play to whatever will keep us online, which is often our weaknesses, like vanity and fear, rather than our strengths.
Right. And this is what Google ethicist Tristan Harris calls extractive technology.
That's right. Yeah. So, for instance, if people are scared of folks who are different from them, right, a barrier to kindness and understanding, well, then, as you said, YouTube's algorithm might take someone who's looked at one video that has a political leaning, and then the suggestion might be the next most extreme version of that view, and then the next most extreme, all the way until this person is totally terrified of people who are different from themselves.
Yeah.
Likewise, on Twitter, William Brady and Molly Crockett and Jay Van Bavel have found that when people tweet in outrage towards people who are different from themselves, they're rewarded with likes and retweets, especially from people who already agree with them. Right. And so those little bursts of social approval then make it more likely that people will express even more outrage. In essence, we're being sort of pumped up to feel separate from others and to express animosity, even hatred towards them.
Yeah. Well, so Tristan Harris, stay with him. He created something called the Center for Humane Technology to create regenerative experiences. I mean, it sounds like it would be the opposite of something that extracts emotion and, spiritual feeling from you. It kind of siphons out your spirituality.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think fear and hatred and vanity are all really powerful psychological forces. But to the point of your series, so are connection and community and empathy. And so a question then becomes, how do we design technologies, online platforms especially, that help us express that deep sort of affinity with others that resides inside us?
Yeah.
So Juliana Schroeder at Berkeley has found that when people read somebody's opinion as opposed to hearing them in their own voice talk about that opinion, they're less likely to see that person as fully human.
Yeah.
So we're missing out on some of the cues that allow us to recognize our common humanity with others.
Okay, so talk about how technology and websites are seeking to change that. One of the sites is called Change of View. Tell us about that.
So on Change of View, people post about things that are controversial, even troubling. But the incentive structure is different from that of Twitter. So on Change of View, you have to kind of post a long opinion, and you have to be open to having your view changed, hence the title of the site. And when other people respond, they also have to engage thoughtfully and open-mindedly. And whereas on Twitter, for instance, you might receive a retweet for insulting somebody personally, on Change of View, other people can reward you with what are called deltas.
Hmm.
This is the recognition from a reader that, hey, you know, what you said actually made me see things differently. So in other words, you're rewarding people not for inflammatory posts. You're rewarding them for being thoughtful and for really engaging with each other.
Okay, and you say that this results in these, you know, beautiful long threads of conversation. But my first response, and cynic in me says, wait, this hasn't been hacked yet, you know, by trolls, by people who really don't want to have thoughtful conversations.
Yeah, so Change of View is a moderated site.
Ah.
You know, and I think that part of it comes down to what type of regulation do we want to have on online communities. I think that's part of the issue here, is sort of how do we keep these communities sort of true to their ideals?
Yeah, there's a one called Rare Connect. Now, this is where, again, the internet can be, you know, what the hope was it would be. This is for people who have rare illnesses, a place for them to connect and discuss it.
Yeah, rare illnesses are a paradox, right? They affect less than 1 in 1,000 people, but there are so many of them, like hundreds of them, that basically more than 1 in 10 people has an illness where they probably have never met another person who has it in real life. So that can be really isolating, stigmatizing, but online communities, including lots of Facebook groups within larger sites like Rare Connect, offer these individuals a chance to find a community of people who understand and share their experiences.
Well, then you have Coco and Seven Cups. And by the way, we're going to list all of this at herenow.org. But it's sort of like a GoFundMe for emotions or something. You know, people get on and they can actually express a struggle. Other people can step in to provide support, even if it's just a conversation. There was a 2015 survey. Seven Cups users described this kindness that they received, you write, that it was as helpful as professional psychotherapy.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I certainly don't want to suggest that going to an online message board could be a replacement for professional help, especially if people are really in crisis. But, you know, a lot of us are dealing with just sort of mundane stress, anxiety, and we just want to talk to somebody. And we think of the anonymity of life online as a barrier to social connection. But on some of these sites, it can actually facilitate it. Mm-hmm. I might be able to open up about something that's facing me more easily to a stranger than I would even to people who I do know. And on these sites like Seven Cups, there's just this huge community of people waiting to empathically listen and respond. And it can be hugely affirming for both parties.
And in fact, you cite a psychologist who did a study.
That's right. Bruce Doré and his colleagues studied Coco. And they've basically looked at users who were either going on Coco to ask for help or going on Coco and sort of providing support to others. Believe it or not, the ones who had the most positive outcome were not those who were receiving help, but the ones who were giving help to others.
Yeah.
Oftentimes we think of kindness to others as something that sort of will deplete us. But instead, it turns out being kind to others helps us as well.
There are other sites, Random Acts of Kindness. We actually did a story on that. Will You Stand, the letter U, which helps bystanders, you know, be able to stand up for somebody they see being wronged.
I guess the message of regenerative technology is that there are tons of people, millions of people who, if they could, would want to interact in a more productive and kind way online. The question is, how do we create those opportunities for them and make sure that they're available to everybody?
Yeah. And what can we as consumers of technology do to kind of hold Google and Facebook, you know, hold their feet to the fire for how much they've been a part of propelling hatred.
Well, I mean, Tristan Harris and others are trying to work in part with these platforms. I think a lot of people at Facebook and Twitter are sort of now thinking a lot more intentionally about how what their platforms have done, and maybe if they can have a more positive impact. As users, what can we do? We can vote with our feet or vote with our clicks, as it were, and try to spend time online in places that make us feel connected. That begins with what I call an internal audit. When I'm online, at least, and trust me, Robin, I also feel hopeless often when I'm on Twitter especially, but I try to ask myself, is this the experience that I'm looking for? Or is there something that I can do today online that will be more positive? Instead of tweeting in anger, can I support somebody? Can I message a friend on Facebook who I haven't talked to in years? Or find somebody who's expressing struggle and let them know that I see them? If we all make choices like that, well, that's different than sort of regulation and putting platforms' feet to the fire, but at least we can start a movement from the ground up.
That's Stanford Professor Jamil Zaki talking about the secular spiritual connections that you can possibly make through technology. Jamil, thank you.
Thank you.
And next week, a look at the growing movement to bring spirituality into the classroom. Again, not religion, but a sense of humanity. We'll join hundreds of people working with grade schoolers to college students at the Spirituality in Education Conference at Columbia University's Teachers College.
Public school educators, independent school educators, charter schools, philanthropists, nonprofits that are exploring how can we get children and adolescents to be mindful, sensitive, conscious. So,
the folks who go to meditation dens and yoga classes, wonderful, wonderful people, but they are coming to us with a sense that that's a little bit shallow. So to do mindfulness in the, you know, pay for 10 sessions in the strip mall, you know, something's missing.
The conference was conceived by psychologist Lisa Miller. You can get a jump on Monday's story by reading her book, The Spiritual Child.
Droughts are becoming more frequent across the United States, especially to the West. A third of Texas is in a drought right now, during what should be one of the wettest seasons. On the banks of the Llano River, 120 miles northwest of San Antonio, among the cactus and mesquite trees, there is a house that researchers hope will change the conversation about water conservation. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
Atmospheric scientist Brian Ansel walks past a small wind turbine, past a beige, double-wide prefabricated home with a solar array, and around the corner to a central piece of his experiment, a 10,000-gallon water tank filled with rainwater.
This is the water tank. So all the rain off the roof goes into pipes that go underground and then up that gray pipe into the top of the tank. Pressure sensor, it sits on the bottom and knows how much water is sitting on top of it. That data goes to the cloud.
He bends over and turns on the spigot of a smaller tank. He and his co-investigators want to change people's conservation behavior and how we live. They'll do it with this spacious 4-bedroom house. Despite its bland exterior, it has something most houses don't have, a smart home system that monitors every drop of water and every watt of electricity, and it'll tell you how to use it.
We are engineering a social change.
Social scientist and co-investigator Carol Lindquist says our end-of-the-month water and electric bills aren't enough to influence us. Subjects living here will know exactly how much water they have in their tanks, how much they're using in real time, how much rain is coming, and most importantly, suggestions on how to make the water last. So say there's no rain in the forecast, which isn't uncommon in these loamy hills. The system will tell you, hey, run the dishwasher every 3 days instead of every day, and you may need to shower every other day.
And you say, oh man, it's hot. It's summer. It's Texas. I want to shower every day.
Users have to decide either make the sacrifice or risk running out and getting water from the grid.
So you accept some of the recommendations and reject others. I think that's the key. You don't have to be conserving. You can choose to be conserving.
They'll test the house out on couples for 6 months at a time. They don't expect any problems recruiting people to this out-of-the-way field station south of Junction, Texas, despite the area being known more for its deer population than its nightlife.
We've had so many people of all ages, retired couples, you know, graduate students, and everybody in between, saying, wow, can I apply?
Subjects will do long interviews on how it's going and keep an online journal. The Home Utility Management System, or HUMS, will be improved based on these suggestions. Because what's the point of making a system that people don't want to use, says Ansel.
I think it's first and foremost a test bed, and that's how we tweak things and, you know, make it useful in society. I think our end goal is, like we said, to get this in the mainstream.
The U.S. relies on massive grids of power and water. When these things go down, it's catastrophic. Puerto Rico suffered mass water issues after Hurricane Maria. Then there's the increase in drought in the American West and globally. Nusha Ajami with the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment says we need to change how we think about water.
It's extremely important the era of mindless consumption is over. And if we don't pay more attention, if we don't try harder to engage people in the process, eventually we'll get to a point that we don't have water.
People are adaptable, she says. They just need the information and the know-how. The HUMS experiment, which is expected to launch this year, may help to do just that. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
One in four Americans has a disability. That's roughly 57 million people in the United States. And yet, up until recently, we hadn't heard much about disability rights in the race for the White House. Advocates are now calling on Democratic presidential candidates to put forth policies that address the issues important to them. For more on where the candidates stand, we're joined by Rebecca Coakley, director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca was part of Senator Elizabeth Warren's Disability Plan Working Group and advised several other candidates. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya.
Let's start with Senator Warren. We know that she used to be a special education teacher. These are issues that she's been very vocal about. Her plan has been particularly applauded. Tell us why.
There's a couple of reasons. I think first and foremost, you actually used the term special education. And I think that's important to note because I think it highlights something unique about this election season. In particular, Senator Warren very early on in the campaign would refer to herself as a special needs teacher. And that sort of description is considered pretty offensive by people with disabilities. Our needs aren't special. Our needs are the same as everybody else's. Just how we access those issues and those rights is different. And the community actually directly reached out to Senator Warren and said, please refer to yourself as a special education teacher, not a special needs teacher. That term doesn't describe us. And she took that feedback very positively and very proactively changed her language, changed her rhetoric, changed even the language immediately on her campaign's website to be more reflective of the feedback that she actually took from disabled people, which I think actually shows sort of a next step in the progress being made by people with disabilities. And, you know, she is one of eight candidates so far who've released plans that incorporate the issues of people with disabilities. And then we've had three other candidates release sort of guiding principles that they're thinking about at this point in time. It's an exciting time.
Let's talk a little bit more about those plans. Last week, Senator Amy Klobuchar also released her disability plan. It was not well received. What was missing?
I think the challenge with Senator Klobuchar's plan, while very thoughtful and very wide-reaching, is there were a number of things that were very concerning to the disability community, particularly as it related to mental health and to health care in general. While she did support language supporting deinstitutionalization of people with disabilities, her mental health plan, which was dropped previously, does support repealing what's called the IMD exclusion inside of Medicaid policy, which prevents Medicaid dollars going to the institutionalization of disabled people. At the same time, there are certain parts of her plan focusing on outpatient treatment of people with mental illness that are very concerning because they actually involve law enforcement in the dispersing of medications for people with disabilities. And let's be honest, when it comes to the law enforcement in the disability community, we typically don't have positive outcomes. We know that roughly from NPR and the Washington Post's own reporting, roughly 50% of individuals who are killed by law enforcement are people with disabilities. And yet when you look at the justice that follows that, often what we see is, in fact, not justice.
I want to ask you about candidate Andrew Yang. He shared with us that his son has autism, and he released a health care policy plan with a section on disabilities. But there was some pushback that this plan was confusing, specifically how disability benefits would be impacted by the center of Yang's policy, which is the universal basic income. Your thoughts?
It's always exciting to see people with a personal connection to the disability community engaging in these conversations. I think, however, it's been a real challenge to understand just the impact that the UBI proposal put forth by Yang and his campaign would have on the disability community. $1,000 a month, while helpful for a number of people, if it doesn't stack on top of somebody's health care or somebody's lighting and heating assistance or their nutrition benefits, that $1,000 is not going to make a significant difference. Mm-hmm. Additionally, for people with disabilities who might actually have asset limits or restrictions on the amount of money that they can have in a savings account, that UBI would actually take away benefits.
You've written about the economic impact for people living with disabilities in the way of health care and other costs, as you just mentioned. This is a heavy burden for many who have limited incomes, if incomes at all. And you've argued that candidates need to address this. Can you tell us more about what you want to hear and see from the candidates?
What we want to hear and see from the candidates is we want a seat at the table. We're tired of people with disabilities being treated as the literal or the figurative short bus, and people talking to parents or providers or caregivers. While those voices are relevant, they shouldn't be centered in a conversation that directly impacts the lives of people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so for us, in thinking about the economic issues, there's a hashtag that we often use on Twitter. It's hashtag CRIPTAX, or the CRIPTAX. And there's research coming out that shows that roughly every person with a disability spends between $1,000 and $7,000 a year on unreimbursable expenses as it relates to being a person with a disability. It might be software that you need for your computer to be able to operate it at home. For me as a little person, it means that I spend roughly twice as much on clothing as the next person because I have to pay to have every piece of my clothing altered. For somebody with a vision impairment, it may be the use of a magnifier or other assistive technology. It really varies. I mean, we see today where roughly one-third of GoFundMe accounts are tied to healthcare. I can count on one hand off the top of my head five disabled people I know who are crowdsourcing to purchase a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And people often don't think that these items are expensive. B, they don't realize that life without these items is a crisis. And so I think there's still such a lack of understanding about the actual tangible lives of people with disabilities and, frankly, the actual cost of being a person with a disability. I think there's a lot of expectation that, oh, if you're disabled, the government takes care of everything for you. When we know that that's actually not the case, and we know that the average person can't live on Social Security benefits. Nobody is getting wealthy off of Social Security.
I want to ask you about something else. Late last year, the Trump administration proposed changes to Social Security that could leave many people living with disabilities without financial support. I'm thinking about disability policy and wondering if it has become a partisan issue, and really what's the future of actually getting any proposed policy passed?
I think there's disability has always had a unique role in its presentation as being a bipartisan issue. The ADA was passed with a number of Republican lead sponsors, among them, Senator Bob Dole. And it was passed under an administration governed by a president, George H.W. Bush, who was the father of a child with a disability. And so I think there has been a tremendous challenge in maintaining that sense of disability as a bipartisan issue across both sides. I think as we continue to see, frankly, the media posit people with disabilities as fakers, takers, and moneymakers, where that isn't the case. We're still fundamentally struggling to access our rights on a daily basis. This is an election year. Over 60% of polling places still have one sort of impediment in one way, shape, or form for disabled people being able to access their right to vote. The ADA is 30. this is unconscionable, but yet we continue to see people with disabilities treated as if we're acting or asking for special treatment instead of just the same rights that anybody else has.
Moving forward, what issues will you be watching for as we move through the 2020 election season and that you'd like for all of the candidates to take on?
You know, I think writ large, as we've seen candidates talk about their economic agendas, people with disabilities are still paid subminimum wage. People with disabilities are still prevented from being able to save money or own a home. There is still a challenge in terms of accessing the general education curriculum for a lot of students. We have states right now that are actually passing laws saying that in order to enroll this next year in school, you have to disclose if you've received any mental health treatment. So we still have so much further to go. And I think it's really important for our candidates to not be setting disability aside as, oh, it's just for those that small percentage of people, when we know that a third of American households have a person with a disability in there. And so disability issues are Americans' issues.
That's Rebecca Coakley, director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today, Tanya.
Baseball's sign-stealing scandal cost two World Series winning managers their jobs this week. The Houston Astros fired A.J. Hinch after Major League Baseball released the results of its investigation and suspended him for a year. Then the Boston Red Sox and their manager Alex Cora parted ways after Cora admitted he played a central role in the Astros' sign-stealing scheme when he was the bench coach in 2017, the year they won the championship. The next year, Cora managed the Red Sox to the championship, and baseball is investigating whether the sign-stealing scheme moved north with him to Boston. Wait, what? A Boston team cheating? No. And just today, the scandal claimed another manager, Carlos Beltran of the New York Mets. He played on that 2017 Astros team and was implicated in the investigation. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
What are you saying about the Bruins?
And that football thing? Listen, sign stealing, you know, figuring out those hand gestures the catcher makes or those ticks from a coach in the dugout, you know, touch hat, touch ear, trying to decode that. That's as old as baseball. So what happened here?
It is, and that's why when there's a runner on second base, the catcher will go through a more complex series of signs because they know they have to guard against an opponent stealing their signs and knowing what pitch is going to come. So I make an analogy to, you might think it's crazy or people might think it's crazy, there are rules of law, the law of war, but there's a difference between actions carried out on a battlefield and, say, assassinations, right?
Okay.
And so if you're using a camera in the outfield to peer into a catcher when they don't even think there's a runner on second, so they are not trying to disguise their signs, that is an entirely different process. And it's not just that the use of technology is against the rules of baseball, which is true. It really is another order of unethical behavior, and that's why Major League Baseball came down so hard.
Yeah, it's part of the game to try to discern it just by looking. It is completely not right to use technology to do it. And so Alex Cora, you know, he seems to be admitting. I mean, he's the one who said, I got to go, you know, from the Red Sox. He seems to be admitting he was central in this. What did he do? Do we know?
I think that he knew he had to go because he was implicated in the MLB report. And he was implicated, strongly implicated, because it does seem that this player-driven scheme, and that's what the Major League Baseball report said, it did name one member of the coaching staff, and that was Cora. So it would become untenable, especially after the Astros fired their manager and their GM, for the Red Sox, who are sitting there with this person, just as culpable, in fact, more culpable than Hinch, the manager of the Astros, was, because the baseball report never even put the blame on Hinch, but they did say he was in charge. So therefore, Cora knew that he was going to be fired, and he fell on his sword a little bit.
Look, in 2017, before he came, the Red Sox were fine. They were taping signals and then watching them in the back room and then sending intel back to the team.
Yes.
That's the year the Astros won the championships. They won the next year with Cora. Red Sox won the next year with Cora in 2018. The Los Angeles Dodgers were the team, but that was the team that lost both years. How are they receiving this information?
they're not happy. The L.A. City Council, in a political act of that no one will ever blame a politician for doing this, has demanded that Major League Baseball give them trophies. So no one's getting voted out of office for rallying around the local team. But it's not just the Dodgers. You know, every team the Astros beat along the way has been somewhat victimized. It goes down to the player level. It has been noted that Aaron Judge, who lost the American League MVP award to Astros player Jose Altuve, back when he lost the award in 2017, put out a gracious tweet saying, "Way to go, you deserve it." He has since deleted that tweet. Mm-hmm. So there are these little ripples from other players looking at this and saying this wasn't business as usual, that gives you some idea of why this isn't just, you know, signs are always stolen.
But stay with now. Now we have three teams that need new managers and, you know, pitchers and catchers and the start of spring training a month away.
Yeah, and teams that need new general managers. And the Astros were supposed to be this juggernaut for years to come, and they have a great core and a great lineup, but they have no leadership, and that's a big problem. And the Red Sox, the team that won the American League team that won the World Series right after the Astros, they're in a similar situation. This is the fallout of this will be felt throughout the year.
And just, you know, I mean, what were they thinking? Wherever Alex Cora went, the championship went with him, and maybe some video cameras. I don't know. We have a minute left. I just want to make sure we ask you. The WNBA, the Women's League, has a tentative new contract that will finally pay the salaries and give them individual hotel rooms. Just quickly, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the salary cap per team goes from $1 million to $1.3. A 30% increase in salary cap is huge in the world of sports, and it shows the NBA's commitment to the WNBA. It's not a league that makes money, but it is a league that where the NBA, the parent organization, in some cases owners of some of these teams, they know it's important to cultivate a women's auxiliary or something actually even more than that.
Yeah, okay, so good news there on that front. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. As I said to someone here today, you know, nice, what is that, pine tar on your baseball bat? Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
The sound of a factory sewing machine is rarely heard in America today.
More than 95% of American apparel is imported. There is somebody making clothes in America. There are not that many people.
What it takes to make clothes in the USA, next time on Here and Now.